This episode of The Edge is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
What have you done out there on the edge of Federation space?
Hello and welcome to Tracks from the Edge, Trek FM's show in which we take a look at every episode of Star Trek Discovery and provide audio commentary for it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Max.
And here we are with the big second season finale of Star Trek Discovery, Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2.
Mm-hmm. Part 2-ing is Such Sweet Sorrow.
There you go. See, that was the that's what I was looking for last week, and you figured it out. You hacked that Gibson.
What do you mean?
I was like, part one. Is Such Sweet Sorrow Part One. I was trying to find the pun.
Oh, you shouldn't have tried that hard. I just came up with that on the top of my head, and now I regret it because I think it was stupid.
No, it was good. It was great. It was great. It's probably the best thing you'll say tonight.
Okay.
So, yes, Such Sweet Sorrow Part Two.
It's the second part.
Yep, and we're going to be providing audio commentary for it. Before we do, just like to note that. The day that we're recording this is the day that they begin shooting the Picard show.
Mm-hmm.
And stay tuned for the till the end of this episode for a little announcement that we have. Nothing to get super duper excited about, but something that, you know, might be a little.
Get your fireworks ready.
Yeah, I think you're overselling it.
The champagne.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway. Should we start this up?
Oh, my God. Absolutely. Let's do it.
Okay. So we've got a little further to go on this episode here, at least at the time of recording, because they have a promo for, like, that Ridley Scott TV show.
Yeah, because, Strange, you know, Angel.
That's what you,
or,
that's what
or
you
as
do.
They say in the streets, Strangel.
Okay, so we're 50 seconds in right now, but, you know, it's going to be different for everywhere else in the world, and probably temporally it's different as well. It's like a it's like a time crystal. It changes over time.
Like a time crystal, there are no rules to this.
Yeah. So we're starting in the black right before the previously on segment. And Max, if you're ready.
Totally ready.
We'll do a countdown and start it up in 3, 2, 1, start. Previously on Star Trek Discovery.
It's the Enterprise, and then Burnham, and then a screen, and then an admiral who's dead.
Spoilers.
Oh, my God.
So,
don't watch this before you watch the episode. Don't put this on while you're watching it for the first time, you wackos.
So, my wife and I were talking about this episode a lot, and the thing that she kept on saying is, I don't understand the time travel in this episode.
Mm, yeah, I get that.
And I kept on saying, like, yeah, I think that's probably because it doesn't really make a lot of sense. But am I wrong? Does it make sense and I'm just not seeing it?
Well, at a certain point when you're trying to figure out the time travel in storylines, sometimes the best approach is not to try to figure out how to make the time travel make sense, but to try to figure out how the writers think the time travel makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the approach that I took.
Well, that I can see to some extent, but we'll get into it as we go along. Right now, we're still going through this previously on. And this episode does a lot of stuff, a lot of interesting stuff that we'll definitely get into because it's some pretty crazy stuff. But hey, you know, it took me forever to get last week's episode edited and out the door, so it wasn't posted until after this episode aired. But
yeah,
boy, we totally called the Sequest 2032 thing. They totally Sequest 2032'd this show.
Yeah, they pulled a classic Sequest 2032 move.
That's, yeah,
it's definitely what it was.
Yep. So here we are. The battle is about to begin. Lots of cool visuals in this. The special effects are amazing. And, you know, not only are they technically well done, but I feel like from a, you know, sort of like direction standpoint, like as far as like shot composition and camera movement and everything, it's really well done. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, this episode is directed by Olatunde Osunsanmi. And
yeah. Well,
he is directing one of the two animated short treks, which are going to be airing in the coming months. And at first you're like, but he does live action. But then you look at this and you're like, oh, he does animation too, and he's really good at it, apparently. So that's cool.
Yeah, I have no qualms.
Yeah, I'm excited to see it.
My qualm stack is empty at this point.
Yeah. So, two ships, one destiny.
Yeah.
Where others see something, I see... I forget that line from Matrix Reloaded.
Here's
the Revolutions. Right. I don't even know anymore.
It was the end of Reloaded.
Okay.
So this scene takes place, and I guess we're going to talk about our conversations with our wives, because when I was watching this with my wife, she was like, "What, they're building it now? They didn't have it ready?" And I'm like, "I guess they're building it now." And she's like, "But they had time to all like do record their tearful goodbyes to everybody." But they're like, "Oh, let's save the building the time suit to the last second. Like the schedule looks like it'll be fine. We'll be able to get it in there." And it's like, "Well, I mean, the time crystal isn't even going to be ready until like the suit's done." I'm like, "Yeah, but get the suit done. Get what you can get done first."
I mean, you know, you can criticize that, but I mean, I just took a trip to, you know, it wasn't even far. We just went to Indianapolis and...
You recorded your tearful goodbyes to all of your loved ones because you were going to be in Indiana for a period?
Well, I'm just saying that you always put off packing to the very last minute, you know, and then you end up leaving late. So
the difference is if you forget to pack anything, you can still go. Like, probably not going to die. Like, no. if you don't pack your passport and you're going overseas, you're not going overseas.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, while we were talking about that, we missed maybe the coolest, craziest thing in this entire episode, the 3 split screen conversation.
Yeah, yeah. And I took note of that and I thought, like, is this a big deal?
It's one of those things where it's never been done in Star Trek before.
Yeah.
And it is so weirdly 70s comedy sort of, I don't even know what, that I really, really appreciate it because it is like a very goofy choice to make in a very serious scene. And it's a lot of fun and I love it.
Yeah, I mean the little dividers between the frames was an interesting choice. I definitely
the way they go from 2 to 3, you know, like in Mean Girls when they do the 3-way call sneak attack thing.
Yeah, yeah, it's just like Mean Girls. It was a weird moment. I didn't freak out or anything. I wasn't like overly like flipped out. Oh, I'm a little weirded out by the angel silhouette behind Leland and his view screen image, but whatever.
Interesting.
there's a lot of weird stuff going on in this episode. And so, like, that little split screen thing, I was like, okay, I guess that's a thing. And then, like, this happened, and I was like, okay, so he's got, this thing going on, and now there's a bunch of drones flying out of there. And I was like, guys, would Control do that dramatic pause nonsense?
Yeah, why not? It feels it feels like a very Transformers moment, right? Where, like, you're like, we've got you now. And then they're like, oh, no, I'm going to transform into Devastator. And then you're like, oh, my God, I didn't know that he could do that. You know?
Yeah. And in Transformers, you have to, like, just accept, okay, this is a continuity where, like, some of the robots talk like blaxploitation characters. Apparently that's fine. But this is a thing where, like, there's an evil AI that wants to kill all of the people. And he's, like, talking to some people, and they're like, well, we got you outnumbered. And he's like, oh, do you, pitiful humans? Well, guess what? I have a whole bunch of drones. Look at that. See how I didn't deploy them earlier so that I could have this moment for some reason? I bet you're pretty impressed with me. Yeah. For some reason, that matters.
I like it. Did you notice a couple names missing from this? These credits are Jay Beatty and Dan Dworkin, the guys who created the Scream show, and they also wrote the episode where they go to Talos 4, which is considered, you know, by the fans to be the best episode of Discovery so far. It's like,
who are these people? Who are these people?
Just fans.
Which fans?
I don't know.
Names.
The ones that go on IMDb and rate episodes of Star Trek. I don't know. It's just one of those things where it's like, they're like, hey guys, let's just come in for one episode and write, you know, the best episode of the show, and then we're gonna leave. See ya. Nice knowing you. Bye.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. Fine. It's the best episode of the show. It has a weird structure where the Talosians are very interested in people's backstories.
So this battle is pretty awesome. I would say this is up there with one of the best Star Trek space battles ever, right? I mean, it's got to be. So,
I mean, I don't think that it's a particular, I don't think it's a bad one. I don't put it in the bottom. I just feel like there's, because there is so much happening, there are so many things out there.
Yeah.
Like there, it's clear that there isn't really a through line, like a tactical through line in this battle.
No, but I mean, one of the cool things that they do about it is they really do take sort of like a bird's eye view, I guess you could say, of the battle, you know, where you see sort of like positioning and stuff like that. Because, I mean, that's one of those things which has always sort of like hampered the freneticism of these space battles in Star Trek, is that it's essentially just two massive battleships just like hurling cannonballs at each other, right? I mean, that's like the nature of the thing. So to like see, I mean, I don't know, I think they did a pretty good job of just kind of like showing the scale here. I mean, okay, so like what's your what's one of your top Star Trek space battles?
Well, number one is Wrath of Khan.
So yeah, I would go with Undiscovered Country myself, but you know, whatever. So Wrath of Khan is pretty.
Well, I think Undiscovered Country kind of cheats a little bit. Like, you know, it's a solid bit, but it's not quite as well structured. But whatever. So they're in a fight for their lives, and a big chunk of this has been foreseen by Michael when she touched the crystal in the previous episode.
Yeah, but it's only a possible future.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it's a possible future, but apparently so is Pike's future. It was also a possible future.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that because they were saying, like, it's a possible future unless you take the crystal and then it becomes, you know, permanent, right?
No, yeah, that doesn't work. That doesn't make any sense because, like, holding a crystal doesn't make any difference unless the crystal is...
it's a time crystal?
No, honestly, no. Because the time crystal doesn't make that future like a done deal. What the time crystal does is it depicts the future where you have the time crystal. like, if you don't take the time crystal can't foresee your future.
Okay.
So it might still happen very similarly to that. But the time crystal is showing you the future where you took the time crystal.
Well,
but apparently the time crystal cannot predict events that happen when time travel is involved.
But maybe that's just because she didn't take the time crystal. You know, I mean, maybe they're like, oh, but here's another theory, which I think makes perhaps more sense, is like the guy, the Klingon guy who played the other two Klingon guys.
T'Navik, I think his name was, or T'Vanik?
Yeah.
T'Navik.
I mean, that's what I was going to say. Maybe they have like this mythology built around the time crystals, but it's not necessarily accurate. So he tells Pike this, and Pike believes it because he seems like, you know, an authority on the subject, but in reality it doesn't necessarily have any basis in fact.
Sure. I was going with that last week, and this week I'm like, okay, well, apparently that's not the case, because we pretty clearly see that it predicts Pike's future.
Well, but I mean, it's not to say that it doesn't. It's just to say that, you know, it can, but it doesn't necessarily have to. Anyway.
Right. So sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. Where's the logic behind that? Well, no, a time crystal that can see the future with like ridiculous accuracies occasionally?
It predicts a possible future, but it could change. So like, you know, Pike was like, if that future is real, then, you know, if I stay in here, then nothing bad can happen to me.
All right.
And then Cornwell's like, yeah, but what if you're wrong? Yeah, and it's like, maybe if he would have stayed there, then he would have blown up, right?
No, because then what you're dealing with is another thing. He can't have stayed there. It's not a thing he could have done.
Okay, I mean, that could be. I don't know.
Future is in some ways set because he's locked into a series of events. Now, theoretically, that series of events could change with the help of some time travel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that we get into a big problem when we include, like, knowing the actual future. Because we know the actual future, we know that Michael Burnham definitely goes into the future and we never see her again. At least in all of the previous Star Trek movies and TV shows. So, like, that kind of complicates things because we know that, like, she's not there. So time travel has to happen in order for her to be gone. This event has to take place in order for that to happen. So if she doesn't, then Control doesn't kill everyone. If she doesn't, then Control kills everyone. And Star Trek, as we know it, doesn't happen.
Well, but we don't necessarily know that she's going to succeed. I mean, like, even after seeing this and seeing them go to the future, I'm like, so how long are they going to be there for? And then, you know, read an interview with Alex Kurtzman the next morning where he's like, forever.
Yeah,
and I'm like, okay, well, then let's do this then, you know?
Obviously, yes, of course they're going to be there forever. There's no way around it. Think about the timeline where they don't go into the future, where they don't stay there for the rest of Star Trek history.
Yeah.
All right? They don't stay there. They come back. If they don't, that's a different timeline, and that screws things up, and that would violate the principle, like the main dramatic thrust of this episode that happens at the climax.
But it's not like that hasn't been done before. I mean,
I agree. I agree. But that means that this sequence of episodes has to be built around this idea that time crystal's depiction of the future is accurate.
Sure. But I've seen enough.
I'm giving them a lot of credit here. I'm saying that they thought this through.
Okay. I'm just saying I've seen enough Star Trek to be surprised when they do something as bold as Sequest 2032-ing the show.
Yeah, I mean, look, we all want to be Sequest 2032. I get that. I mean, that's a high bar, apparently, that you want to clear. Sure. I'm just saying that if you accept that what they're saying in this episode and significantly this whole season, like, they have to go to the future. That's the only way this works. And it definitely was going to happen. Like, it already occurred to a great extent. Like it is a fact of the universe that it occurred.
Uh-huh.
So there's basically no way around it. And the time crystal can't see that because the time crystal cannot see things that don't happen in linear time. Pike is stuck in that timeline. Like the Tanavik says, like, this is like your future. If you don't choose it, you may have a different one. You may have a different one. It's not the same thing as saying, like, you will definitely have a different future.
No, and but Michael holding I think what he was saying was, like, if you choose it, then you won't have a different one.
Yes, because this is the future where you choose it.
Okay. All right.
Like, it's basically I was talking about this on Twitter, and like my example was like, it's basically like a GoPro that sees the future. So if you go to the store and you buy the time GoPro and you look at the footage, like the footage is going to be of you owning a time GoPro.
Okay.
It's not going to be the footage of you that didn't buy the time GoPro and just left it at Space Best Buy.
Okay. All right.
So this is the crystal showed Michael the future where she had the crystal and she didn't use a time suit to jump into the future.
Okay. Fair enough. So, okay. I'm sure they say this in the dialogue, but I can't remember what it is. Why does she need to jump out of this thing? Like, because she jumps to the thing and then like a bunch of people fly around her and then she lands on like another thing.
Yeah, the justification is it's tactical. It's about getting her out far enough to create the wormhole so that they can fly through it and not destroy anyone with the event horizon of the wormhole.
Okay. So like Spock, because, yeah, he crashes and that's why he's there. And so he wasn't supposed to be there, because I'm like, why didn't she just stay in the thing? But then again, I don't know. I guess these don't have transporters on them in the 23rd century, right? Because I was going to say, why not just stay on the thing with it? It doesn't matter. Okay, but this is pretty cool, right? I mean, here she's like flying all over the Enterprise and stuff like that. Things are spinning around. I mean, this is some good stuff. This is some high quality, like, you know, like theatrical motion picture quality stuff, right? I'm digging it.
Oh yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, like I have mixed feelings about this, largely because like of like much deeper issues than like what they do in this episode exactly. Like, to me, the time travel is like part of a larger problem that I have with this incarnation of Star Trek. But I'll get to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said for what they do at the end of this episode, and I've never, like, I think that this may be the single most conflicted I've ever been about an episode of Star Trek. I mean, yeah, because, like, I think what they're doing in here is really cool. I think what it's setting up is amazing. And yet, I think they also do, like, one of the dumbest things I've ever seen in Star
Trek. What's that dumb thing?
Like, literally, like, telling the joke, but for real. The joke that you always tell whenever you do a prequel, which is, you know, and they all took a vow to never speak of these events or characters again.
Oh, that's the thing that you have a problem with?
They literally do that. Yeah, that's the thing that I have a problem with.
Yeah, I don't really care about that.
Okay, that bothered me so much.
Yeah, that is not an issue for me at all. Really? I think that's I think it's a minor. Like, to me, like preserving the continuity of Star Trek is not so complicated, because, like, honestly, if somebody just said like oh, you know, Captain Pike, he was a Gorn the whole time, I'd be like, that's fine.
Oh, whatever. Speaking of which, you know the weird looking alien lady on the bridge of the Enterprise?
Lobsty.
I was thinking she was like, I mean,
that's the name I came up with her in my head that I didn't say to my wife, because I thought that's too stupid.
Yeah, that was pretty dumb. She looks like one of the witches from what was it that that Roald Dahl thing or something, right? You know,
the witches.
Yeah, the witches. Yeah, there you go.
I don't remember the witches from the witches.
I don't know. I'm just saying.
I remember the book. I don't remember how they were described. To me, she looks like what like a humanoid being would look like if they were they were indigenous to the planet that was at the end of The Last Jedi.
Okay.
Because she looks kind of like she's got a crystal face.
Okay. Well, anyway, that's Yeoman Colt, who is the yeoman from the cage. And there's been much debate about this online. Like, why did they do that? They don't name drop her in the episode, but they do in the credits. And it's been confirmed that it is her. And people are wondering why they changed it. And I honestly think that the reason they changed it is because the writers were like, oh, Yeoman Colt. Let's have her on this show. And they just wrote Yeoman Colt says, ready to fire phasers, Captain, or whatever she says.
Right. And somebody else was like, let's make Yeoman Colt a freaky alien.
Right. Not knowing that Yeoman Colt was the yeoman from the cage.
Yeah. Or maybe it's possible that there are two yeomans who are neither one is named Colt, and Pike is just bad with names.
Maybe that's what it is. I mean, they don't say her name in the thing, so they could very easily say, like, oh, no, that wasn't Yeoman Colt. That was, you know, Yeoman Janice. So, you know, whatever.
There are a lot of ways to justify it. That's my point. Preserving the history is not that complicated. It's not that hard to justify it. For me, it's about the internal logic and making sure that all of the people do things that make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And if at the very end you have to say something to justify like the continuity that's been previously established, it's not a big deal to me. I don't really care that much. Like, honestly, if a totally unknown character came in and said, like, all right, for reasons that I don't have time to explain to you, we're never going to talk about them again. I'd be like, all right, okay, that checks out. That adds up.
That's like literally what they do here.
Yep. That adds up, except it's Spock that does it, so whatever.
But here's the thing, and I'm sorry, because we're talking about it now, so I need to bring it up. Like, it wasn't an issue. Like, I keep on saying, like, I've known you for 19 years now. Mm-hmm. If you were to tell me at this very instant, like, I have a half-brother or sister living somewhere in the world, I'd be like, I didn't know that. That doesn't surprise me.
Two half-sisters and one adopted sister.
This is my point. You don't even know how many siblings you have. So, you know what? It's okay for Kirk not to know how many siblings Spock has. Because I didn't know that you had any siblings. I doesn't surprise me in the least. And yet I never thought to ask.
Knowing my dad, that rascal.
All right, well, we won't get into that. But, you know, this is what I'm saying. Okay, yeah, it's not an issue.
And my point is, I don't care either way.
Okay.
I can justify it. It doesn't matter. What bothers me is this. This is the part of the episode where my wife was like, this makes no sense. What is going on?
Oh, mine too. And I agree.
And no, but this is the thing. I was like, I know exactly what's going on, and I am furious.
So explain to us, for everyone who doesn't understand, what is going on?
What is the narrative of this season? If, underneath all of the other stuff, what has this season largely been about?
It's been about trying to figure out what this
signal is. No. Not like a literal thing. What is the theme?
Oh, faith.
There you go.
Uh-huh.
This is what this is. This is the moment where Michael has to say, I have to put my faith in the universe itself.
Uh-huh.
Because time, it has literally been folded in on itself in weird, convoluted ways. The universe has laid out a path for me in the past and the future. The universe is largely a player in this narrative at this point, because she didn't have to go back in time later on and send those signals. Those signals were there for her right at the beginning. She saw events from her own future that she had not done. Her mom didn't get to see that. And her mom is an angel. there's a lot of weird thematic stuff going on in here. She was not an angel. Now she is one, but she has, what do they say about people? They're not like angels because people have free will, but the universe has given her a path and she has to choose that path and she has to place her faith in the universe itself because the universe has given her seven signs that this is her path in the universe. And because apparently the universe plays favorites. It's like, all right, well, we want these people to survive and we don't really care about the rest of them. They're just not that important. Kind of like in Star Trek 2009, where it's like, all right, well, we killed all the Vulcans, but we got these three heterosexual white men on a bridge together. That's great, right? Job done.
See, but I mean, and that's like the one problem that I have with Star Trek 2009, where they're like, you know, things just work out the way they're supposed to.
Things work out the way they're supposed to, unless you're Vulcan.
No. I mean, that, but you know, I mean, here's the thing, right? I love Star Trek 09. I think it's like the best that Star Trek's ever been. And like,
you're wrong.
That thing could have like easily been taken out of it and it would have worked fine. Really, I mean, there were like two or three lines of dialogue which could have, you know, so that bothers me. The idea that like, yes, they were meant to meet Spock in that cave and everything, like that bothers me. But at least it's not like sort of like hinging on that idea. I don't know. Anyway, so okay, here, explain to me though on a more literal level, like why can't she set coordinates for the future? Because she hasn't done something yet in the past?
Yes, because she can't actually like open the wormhole to the future because the system cannot find the coordinates in the future for her. It's almost as if the wormhole in the future for her doesn't exist yet.
Yeah, but then how was her mom able to come back?
Different suit, different circuitry, different wormhole, different everything.
Okay. But okay, then how was, because I mean, but then there's like two other signals, which she's set, right?
But that's the thing. The seven signals appeared at the very beginning of the season. And I'll once again bring this up. Seven signals appear simultaneously throughout the galaxy. If they're moving at the speed of light, you don't see them for a long time and they don't arrive simultaneously. And it'd be impossible to know if they appeared simultaneously because you'd have to know when. I mean, come on, guys.
No. But space, I mean, isn't that just because if you're thinking about it, like from the same, you know, like you could have some guy like standing next to one signal and some guy standing next to another signal. And then they're both like, whoa, I just saw a signal. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. And that doesn't work.
Okay.
Like it doesn't make sense. Like the problem with this signal thing is that those seven signals appeared at the beginning of the season and now she's sending them and we're seeing how like throughout the season we're like, okay, so the seven signals appeared and now they're appearing again, but like individual signals are reappearing but for a larger duration.
Well, yeah, that's the thing that doesn't really make any sense, right? Because they're like, we just saw the seven signals but we can't really pinpoint them. Like, why not?
Yes. Well, because the seven signals appeared for an instant.
Yeah.
And then went away. But, and then one reappeared and stayed there for a big chunk of time, like, let's say 20 minutes.
But you can't.
Long enough to.
I mean, how much time do you need? I mean, you know that you saw the signal. You know that you saw it in a specific point because you were looking at it, right?
But this is the thing. Because you have to justify two things simultaneously. You have to justify them all appearing at the same moment and justify not being able to pinpoint that location. You have to have a guy nearby in order to say, I saw a signal at 6:15 p.m. on Saturday night. And if you don't have a guy there, then you have to have a system that's recognizing signals in space and saying like, oh, that one happened at the same time as that one. But they arrived at the same time. They wouldn't arrive at the same. They'd arrive thousands of years apart.
Okay, but I mean, the other thing is like, why do they appear twice? Why do they all
appear? Why did they appear? There's no justification. There's no explanation for why they appear twice. Michael Burnham is saying in this episode, like, I will make this signal appear. Now, presumably what she's doing is she's making the signal that we saw for an instant at the beginning of the season appear for a longer period of time so that we can track its location, because they're able to track its location. They're like, oh, this one's in the beta quadrant.
No, but she's creating the signals too.
Yeah. What do you mean? That's what I said.
Okay. No, but she's not just, it's not like the signals exist and she's making them appear for longer, right?
No, I mean, to a great extent, what she's doing is making signals that already existed because they're part of the past. She's making the signal that exists.
Okay. All right.
But for whatever reason, the signals have a two-step process. For whatever reason, when she makes a signal...
Well, it makes it, you know,
it flashes,
harder to break into your time suit that way.
You're going with two-factor authentication for like trans-temporal time signals?
I'm just trying to think of something. I mean,
for some, like, you can justify it. You could say, like, because of the signal generation protocol hinging on some sort of, like, sci-fi nonsense. Let's say a particular, like, tachyon burst technique that involves a type of pulse. Because of that, they will actually cascade onto each other and create a kind of echo effect when they're all in sync, which would be like, I don't know, like 6 months earlier than like the original like signal like point. So they would all have a brief flash at a different point in time. And maybe they're in the past, maybe they're in the future. Who knows? In this case, they are in the past. So these signals have two flashes. One is very brief, one is very long.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was going to say that too, but, you know, I just went for the joke.
Yeah, and it's dumb.
Okay, sorry.
It's a dumb justification.
Oh, I thought you meant the joke. So she's setting the signals so that she can go back into the past so that she can then go into the future.
Yes.
Because...
This is how it happens.
Okay.
And the thing about this kind of time travel is so fundamentally strange that you can actually have incredibly bizarre things happen. Like you can have somebody like go back in time and hand someone the blueprints to a time machine and say, you need to build a time machine and then go back in time and give you the blueprints to this time machine. And then that person does that.
Well, that's kind of what happens here.
The blueprints to the time machine. It's exactly what happens here.
Yeah.
And then they go into the future and they build the time machine and they go back. And the people standing around who watch this happen like are like, where did the blueprints come from?
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's what it is. So, and we'll get into that.
They came from nowhere.
Okay.
And that's part of it. That's because sometimes when you deal with this kind of thing, you have to accept that the universe doesn't make any sense. And if that was the story, I'd be fine with it. The problem is they have multiple timelines as well.
Yeah.
And you cannot have multiple timelines where that kind of thing is happening, because that kind of thing presumes that the future and past are immutable.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if you've ever listened to the Star Trek IV fan commentary that Kurtzman and Orci recorded. It's pretty good. But one of the things that was interesting, like this was done for the set, which was coming out to coincide with the release of Star Trek 09. And yeah, one of the things which they're doing throughout the commentary is trying to justify the fact that they were, in essence, in a lot of people's minds, changing the game of the time travel game with Star Trek 09 by creating an alternate timeline instead of it being like a closed loop or whatever. And one of the things which they keep on bringing up as, you know, different things occur in this movie is like, oh no, see, look, they're creating an alternate timeline here. See, that did it, that did it, that did it. And it's almost like they're justifying to themselves that they're changing the way that time travel was done in Star Trek.
Yeah, I get it. That's how I watch everything. Like that doesn't mean anything to me. Like to me, that's them trying to figure it out. Like Star Trek IV is one of the ones that almost works both ways.
Yeah.
And the only problem really is that everyone keeps talking about time travel and everything they're saying is stupid. Okay. They're like, we're in the past. Don't screw up anything. And I'm like, all right, guys, you're in the past. You screwed stuff up already.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things which, you know, we're talking over here is this sequence, which is, I think, clearly influenced by 2001, and which I think is, like, really, really cool. And this is one of those things where...
I think it's somewhat by proxy, because I think it's largely influenced by Interstellar, which was wholly influenced by 2001.
I mean, but there's some shots of, like, her in, you know, almost like a fetal position, which is very reminiscent of, like, the space baby from 2001 and stuff like that. I think it's an amalgam, you know, and then all the light things and everything. Anyway, my point being, like, I love the way that this looks and I love what they're doing with it. I love how abstract it is. And it's one of those things where, like, if I had seen this, like, when I started watching Star Trek 26 years ago now, I would have probably hated it. But now watching it, I think just because of the way that I consume or process media, I'm much more accepting of something like this than I was back then. Like, it doesn't need to be super literal. And I can just sort of, like, you know.
I'm not sure what you mean. What do you mean it doesn't need to be super literal? I got the impression that they were doing something super literal.
I guess they were trying to actually depict something very real. I think like in the visual interpretation where it's like, what are those red lines? What is this stuff? You know, I mean, it's just.
Three-dimensional space folded into two-dimensional space.
Okay.
Folded into one-dimensional space seen on a two-dimensional plane through a three-dimensional lens.
And it can be that thing that makes sense without them explaining it, you know? So here we are on the NSYNC set, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, here's the thing. Like, I was like, hold on a second. So wait, gravity fails, and I'm like, okay, can this be justified with, like, the ship moving? And then I was like, no, because they're moving too fast. If inertial dampers aren't on, then they would be dying.
No, I mean, I think what they mean by gravity failing, it's the same thing as, like, oh, my TV failed. You know, well, the screen still works and I'm getting static, but there's something wrong with it, you know?
Yeah, gravity failing means gravity is now moving in weird random directions.
I think what it means is usually they have, you know, like a gravity plate, which is sitting underneath the bottom of this thing, right?
Right, but now it's rotating around the thing?
Yeah, you know, it got knocked loose, like, you know, kind of like a floater disc, like when you buy a DVD and then, you shake it and you can, like, feel the thing. That's what happens.
It's swinging around from the top of the hallway that has a bulkhead in it to protect from the hole into space?
No, but, you know, you can see, like, the It's complicated.
Buddy, just admit that doesn't make sense.
It works for me, whatever. I mean, but who's to say that they can't flip it around every once in a while? Who's to say that it's not, they don't have the gravity plates on all, you know, four sides or however many it is. And then they're like, you know, on Wednesdays, it's, you know, Gravity Fest, where we just get all crazy because everyone loves that NSYNC video.
Everyone loves the NSYNC video. It comes up a lot.
And we can do that because we have the technology. So why wouldn't you, right?
No, I think that the best justification is that the ship is moving slowly enough in this space battle that what they're experiencing is the G-forces of the ship moving.
Okay. So here they're trying to defuse this bomb, and boy, that blast door really is strong, though, isn't it? I mean, it's just surprising to me how strong that blast door is, but...
Yeah, like, I'm bugged by this whole, like, who needs to stay behind and push the button thing.
Yeah.
Like, because anytime someone needs to stay behind and push a button, I'm always like, guys, we could do something with duct tape and, like, some twine and pull this off. Like,
well, the thing that in this case...
I was like, okay, maybe there's, like, a fingerprint scanner that's, like, proving that you're a person. Because, like, what if, like, you had, like, a guy with a cane and he put a cane there?
Well, they could have gotten one of those R2-D2s to come in, right? I mean, That would have been an option. Transport the R2-D2 in.
Yeah, my wife flipped out. She was like, "Oh my god, it's like Wally!" And I'm like, well, "Yeah, like Bernie, because they've got little burners. Then like they're Bernie. That's cute."
Okay.
And oh, they never come up again.
That's what they're called.
There's a Bernie. There's a robot in Wally called Bernie.
Oh, okay.
Who has this exact same job.
Did you go to the screening of that one when we had it as a projectionist?
I don't remember.
I'm pretty sure you did. That was the last time I saw that movie. So
it's probably true. Yeah, yeah. I saw it and I haven't seen it twice. Oh. So yeah, probably.
Hey, both of us. Cool. Yeah, no, but like the thing that I was thinking about with it was like, okay, this blast door.
That line, "We will wade deep through the ruin of our enemies."
Yeah.
First time I thought she was hot.
I think that says.
I was like, what does Vokes see in this woman? And then she's like, "We will wade deep through the ruin." And I'm like, all right. Okay. All right.
Little glimpse into Max.
I'm not mad at it.
All right. Cool. So anyway, what were we talking about? Oh, yeah. The blast door. Hey, I mean, theoretically, the reason for that blast door is like exactly what it's used for, which is to save the ship. So I guess my question is, why not put that handle on the other side of the door?
Oh, imagine the pranking. That would be terrible. No, it has to be a dead man switch. It has to be like this has to be something that somebody pulls in order to save everyone. Because if you do this, like it's there's no turning back. Like it's over. This is the kind of thing that you have in place when this situation occurs.
I mean, it usually works with an iPad, so.
No, but that's a manual switch. That is the last possible step. That's the Hail Mary of, I don't know, sports.
They even just said that. So, hey, I want to point something out here, which they do here. There's that shot of Saru, where he's in the chair and he's talking and the camera is like moving in like a kind of like a half circle, like it goes to one side of him and then it comes back mm-hmm. to the other side. That's like a thing.
They love doing that.
That's like a thing, which I think like, and I don't really know, but I think it's a thing that, you know, filmmakers do when they're trying to cause like movement, like sort of like whatever, movement more than anything. But it's like something which they assume will only be used in the editing room for like real quick bursts, you know? So like you won't see like a full rotation of like all the way to the left, all the way to the right, all the way back, you know? And
yeah, you assume when you see it the first time, like, oh, right. the ship must be moving to the left.
Right.
And now the ship must be moving to the right. And then you're like, wait, it's doing it like three times.
Right. You'll never get to the end and you'll never move back like inside of a shot. Like you should cut before you get to the end and you should cut.
Absolutely.
And you know, it's,
and it should match the movement of the previous shot in some way.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they do that in Batman Begins a lot. Like when Batman is coming to, you know, take out the Scarecrow, like when he's like in the basement, he's like, oh, we've got a bat here, and he's like looking around all creepy, the camera keeps on going back and forth like that. It drives me up the wall here, but whatever, you know,
it drives you up the wall and onto the ceiling and then onto the other wall because the gravity is failing.
Anyway, it's just one of those things that bothers me because you can see the seams, you can see that wasn't intended in the photography, but the editing changed for whatever reason. And I guess if you go in like Walter Murch's like tiered, you know, editing, whatever, it's important in emotion or something, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. You got to keep the camera moving because the camera's moving in every other freaking shot. So, like, obviously, you got to keep the camera moving. Here we're seeing Pike give different emotions every time the camera passes behind the Admiral's head because it's like a freaking cartoon, apparently. So they have to, like, swipe in a different, like cell for his face to react to a different situation. And like, yeah, we got to keep the camera moving. Guys, Star Trek is getting weird. I don't hate it, but there's a little part of me that's just like, this used to work with a lot less.
You know, I wonder how much less we'll see in the Picard show. I'm kind of thinking a substantial amount less. You know?
I would not hate it if the Picard show was a lot more, you know,
subdued,
staid, stoic, and, you know, stage-like. I would not hate it.
One thing we didn't bring up, Jonathan Frakes, who couldn't care less about an NDA, has stated that he is directing episodes 3 and 4 of the Picard show.
At what point do you think that Star Trek is going to start using Frake as their analog to Frack?
I don't know, but I can tell you when they should start using it. Right now.
Right now.
Frake, yeah.
Yeah, you freaking know it.
You know, after Tilly started saying Frick earlier this season, I switched all of my Fracks to Fricks, but now I'm going with Frake.
Oh, yeah, you know it. I coin stuff every day.
You're the freaking best.
Oh, okay. And this is the point where Spock is like, I know what we're doing, what you got to do. I'm Spock. And you know how in the previous part of this like series, like I've been crazy and then I wasn't crazy, and how this whole time you've been doing the Baltar thing? Like just like at the end of BSG, you have to do the Baltar thing in that episode and realize that, you know, there's a purpose to everything that's happening and you're a part of it. And it really does bug me.
I'm okay with it. Yeah.
If they were doing it the whole time, I don't think I would care. It's just that, like, they're trying to, you know, have their predestination and their alternate timelines too, and you just can't. The universe doesn't make sense that way.
Yeah.
Unless the universe is taking a very active role. Honestly, the only way it makes sense is if like there are, you know, behind the scenes people changing the rules as they go along, like a writer's staff.
Gene Roddenberry.
You think that there is a god of the Star Trek universe and it is Gene Roddenberry?
I mean that was like your, you know, your Galaxy Quest thing that made sense to me, you know.
I no, but that was a god of the show,
yeah,
and a god like a very powerful being, but not an actual like god that was in control of fate.
You know, there was a funny thing. There was like, you know, one of those Twitter polls where they're like, "What Buffy character are you?" You know, one of those things, mm-hmm. Whatever.
Yeah.
And I guess somehow it came across Joss Whedon's timeline, so he responded. He's like, "I'm God." And then he said something like, "No, just kidding. I'm that random dude who gets killed in episode 4. I don't know what he said, but whatever. Anyway, but it was funny. I laughed. I chuckled. Whatever.
Okay, yeah.
So here's where, you know, Burnham says to Spock, I can't remember if it's exactly, yeah, I think it is here, where she's like, you know, there's a universe full of people reaching out to you. Find the person who's furthest from you and reach out to them.
Yeah, Bones.
Is it Bones or is it Kirk? I think it's supposed
it's gotta
to be
Kirk, but honestly, Bones is further Bones. Away. I mean, yeah. Whatever.
But he does that too. And, you know, I don't know. I mean,
he kind of does that too.
I mean, you know, I like that. I don't know. I'm a sucker for things like that, because like anytime they say something like that, I'm like, oh, that's me and Max.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. And I've been trying to figure out for, like,
honestly, I think our relationship works better than Kirk and Spock sometimes. I mean, clearly Spock lied to Kirk for a huge number of years.
About what?
Well, having a sister, for one.
We just found out like 5 minutes ago that you've got 3 of them, and, you know,
I've mentioned it on episodes of shows we recorded.
Well, I took all those off of the internet, so, you know, they don't count anymore. They're no longer canon.
I'm just saying, I haven't kept it a secret. I've just said it and nobody cares.
I'm just saying maybe he wasn't keeping it a secret. Oh, wait, now he is. Okay, never mind.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. There's stuff which is classified and it has to be classified in order to whatever. Anyway, so.
My classified sister, who I'll never see again, but like is sort of totally still alive in a weird kind of way. Like, honestly, I should put some messages on tape so that she can read them later. Oh, I should freeze myself. That's a good idea. I don't think of that.
So, okay. So,
I go to a different timeline entirely.
So now here's a question, which I'm sure they've explained, but I just don't quite understand it. And it's something that my wife brought up again. So the whole thing was they can't come back because the thing that they're using to charge the crystals is like taking a drink of water from a waterfall and you'll drown and it means you can't come back. Okay, so then how was she able to jump back in time to all those different places for the signals?
Because the thing that's going to burn out is when she uses the time crystal to make the wormhole. She's going to use the energy to make a gigantic hole for the Discovery to fly through.
That's why I kind of thought it was something like that. But
like the only problem with that is that right after she does that, she makes another freaking signal.
Well, but no, we don't know that she does that, right? Because she's like, I'll let you know when I'm through. But then like Spock is like, you know, 124 days for me could be like minutes for her. But it could also be the reverse, right? I mean, to your point where they're like, oh, don't worry about going, you know, 930 years in the future because we'll have 930 years to figure out how to get you back to the present.
I agree. I think it's possible that she had like a post-it note on her refrigerator for 30 years that said send seventh signal.
And she's like, I will get around to that.
And then she dies and her granddaughter is looking at it and is like, what is this about? And she talks to a bunch of people and she's like, oh, I think we could actually do that now. And then she pulls it off.
Wouldn't it be weird if like next season was the story of how they were going back to like Boreth to get like another time crystal so that she could send that last signal?
I would love it if season 3 was primarily about the responsibility of informing Spock that they safely arrived by sending the seventh signal.
Yeah. So in this scene here, Georgiou is straight up giggling as she's killing this dude or this, you know, AI or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's a little evil. But I like it.
Yeah, like there's she's got this revenge thread, and I'm like my problem is I'm not sure what she is avenging.
Oh, I think she just didn't like that guy.
That's it. She just didn't like.
Well, she's like he's in my way, you know. And
does say revenge.
Yeah.
I don't know what she's avenging. I don't know. It's not a big deal. It's just like, I get that she's the kind of person who would be like, you know, oh, look at that. The enemy is dying painfully. He really was a terrible monster, and I'm glad to see him die. Like, her giggling is not, like, a crazy thing to me. It's that it's the idea that it's revenge that bugs me. It's just it's a logical inconsistency.
You know, Georgiou, or Michelle Yeoh, as she's called in the real world, she just...
which universe are we in?
She just gave an interview where she was talking about the Section 31 show, and she's like, it's going to be a lot more fun. It's not going to be so serious like these other shows are. It's going to be, you know, a good
Section
time.
Section 31, 950 years in the future. It's going to be really cool.
It's going to be all cool. We're going to be, like, you know, doing some stuff and going to planets, saving the worlds and everything. I mean... You got to think she's coming back, though, right?
I assume that she's coming back. I find it weird because, like, we know that there's going to be a Section 31 show. We know that she's going to be in it, and we know that she's on that ship. There's a lot of stuff that we know already, and it's just weird. Like, why didn't she say, like, all right, job done, escape pod time? Like, she didn't do that. Like, if we had seen her, like, just, like, pull a lever and a shuttle, like, shoot out of the back of the ship, I'd have been like, That's fine. That's enough.
I mean, but like of all the people who don't need to stay in the 22nd century, like she's like number one because it's not even her 22nd century or 23rd century, if you, you know, you want to be all accurate about it. So I'm just saying that it's strange that, yeah, well, it's not strange because she didn't do it. You know, I mean, there's no reason to think that she would come back. And this shot of Enterprise with like big chunk missing from the front of it, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now here's where we get into the cool stuff. I love.
Oh, this was a funny moment. My wife was like, what? Like when they got to the Golden Gate Bridge. and because I'm a Star Trek dork, like I was like, okay, that makes sense. Yeah. That's what we'd be seeing. And she was like, whoa. And I was like, oh, you don't remember? And she's like, I know that that's headquarters, but like, I just didn't, it was a jarring transition. And I'm like, I guess it was.
Yeah. I didn't find it to be jarring. I mean, I thought it was cool, but I also thought what it signified and what we see from here on out in this episode is, you know, pretty amazing. Like the Discovery crew is gone. Right. And the idea that they're like wrapping this up with like the people left behind. Right. I mean, that's cool. Yeah. Like this could be the end of the show. Like they were going to settle on this planet and everything like that. Like you could say like, there, well, there's not going to be a season 3 and we're done. And I love that because it works. It does. It's not a cliffhanger. It has an ending. I mean, yes, there are lots of questions like, well, what happens now, right? Now that they're in the 32nd century. But from a, just like a storytelling standpoint, you could say like, well, this is the end of the series. And, you know, this is the end of the story. And it works perfectly well. And I think that that's really cool. And yeah, that's it. It really works for me. And also, you know, there's, of course, you know, there's been this petition online regarding a Anson Mount-led Captain Pike Enterprise show, which has gotten lots and lots and lots of signatures, you know, because people love the character and his performance so much, and they just want to see that. And it's really interesting because, like, he responded and he's like, thanks. You know, like, he basically said, like, I'd be up for it, but it would take a lot of work in order to get there creatively. And
yeah, we'd have a really limited run.
No, you'd have like 3 or 4 years, you know what I mean? Hey, which could be a selling point, you know? I mean, hey, but whatever, you know? But then.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a really interesting series finale. Like, you know, he's just, yeah, he can't be captain anymore.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, whatever it is that they do, I mean, because he's not, well, whatever, it doesn't matter. Anyway, the point being, like, it sounds like they're considering it. In that Kurtzman interview where he's talking about what they're doing in season 3, they bring it up and he's like, the fans have been heard.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see it happening. I don't really think there's a need for it.
Well, I mean, is there a need for anything? I mean, that's every time everyone's like, yeah. I don't see.
Yeah,
no. But I mean, in terms of like, you know,
I think that the Picard show is something that is actually really necessary.
I mean, I can see what you're saying, right? I can see what you're saying, but for like a lot of these things, it's like, well, we just need to keep it going in some way or another. And but yeah, I don't know. Anyway. It's an interesting thing. Oh, look at that. They're rebuilding Enterprise. It seems like they have to do that a lot.
They do it so often. They got a lot of work to do. There's a lot of unnecessary view screens and blinking lights on that thing right now. Mm-hmm. Just get all that out of there. Go very minimalist. It's just too much. There's too much happening all the time on that ship.
So we missed the whole thing where they're like, we're never going to talk about them again or their crew. We can't even mention Michael Burnham's name. Why? Yeah. Wait, why?
Because control is such a part of the history of why the Discovery disappeared. And control is so dangerous. And the concept of it, like a tactical AI, is so dangerous and so powerful that they have to like make sure that no one ever follows up on any research that was done that led to that, and never tries to recreate the technology, because that would be really bad for all of the people.
Okay, but
so they need to erase the discovery from existence entirely.
And I mean, you can do that, I guess, because even though we think of it as being like, wow, look at all the missions they've gone on and they've played an integral role. I mean, like when we first saw them, which wasn't that long ago, they were like a top secret ship, right?
Yeah, everyone's, and like, they were basically still kind of classified because they're working on one mission that has to do with mysterious signals.
And, you know, you could say like, well, the spore drive, you know, that could be classified, whatever. But they're like, we can never mention the spore drive again. I don't understand why they can't mention the spore drive again. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But why can't you mention the crew?
Because if you look up the spore drive, you'd find the Discovery and Discovery's like history, and that would lead back. So the spore drive, because it was connected to Discovery, has then connected to Control. So the spore drive technology is a problem, even though theoretically it could revolutionize everything.
Okay, so I want to point something out here. There weren't any scenes which started off in rooms that Spock walked through, but I love the fact that the very last scene of the season is us following Spock into a room. So we're through the looking glass. Now we're seeing things from Spock's perspective.
We are. But the thing is, in the previous episode, the first part of the two-parter, we didn't see Spock enter a room through a door, but we did see both of his parents do that. Mm-hmm. So we know where he got it.
Yeah. And I was thinking about something else. First episode of this season, it starts with Burnham walking in on Spock in a room, right?
Yeah.
So now he's like, oh, and he didn't like it, right? He's like, get out of my room.
Was he?
And now he's like, I'll show them. I'll just walk in on their rooms.
And every time they're going to be like, oh, Spock, it's so great to see you. And he's like, that's not the reaction I wanted. Oh, guys. But not emotional, though.
Yeah.
Because I'm logical and stuff and whatnot.
That's kind of cool to see them all on the bridge together, Enterprise doing its thing. And
my first reaction on seeing Beardless Spock was, oh, his jawline is different.
Yeah, it is kind of jarring. I think more than anything, the haircut really threw me off, right? Because he was like all cool, you know, grungy Spock. Oh, and look at this. They pull out of the dome thing just like in the first shot of the cage, but now it's in reverse, and I like that. That's cool. That's cool. It works, and we're off.
It's something. Yeah.
There's the signal.
Yep.
It's a good end. All right. Now the moment you've all been waiting for, I guess.
Yeah.
We have a little bit of announcement. Something which we're formulating. Came up with it a couple days ago, and you know, it's just been
an AI for tactical decision making.
Yes, I think it could work out well.
I think it's a good plan. I don't see a possible downside.
So, Discovery season 2 has ended, and it's been fun. You know, last year was a grind, so much so that we were like, we're done. And then, very thankfully, Amy asked us to come back in season 2, and this season has been a lot of fun. It's been fun talking to listeners and everything like that. And, you know, we were thinking like, hey, why does this have to be end? I mean, parting is such sweet sorrow, as we learned, right? So, what we're going to do, looking to the future, just like Discovery, we were like, you know, they got this Picard show starting up, apparently, at the end of the year. And we're both pretty big fans of Picard. And, you know, we're really looking forward to this show. So what if we were to do some commentaries for episodes and movies which are somehow important, or which we think might be important to this show? Like the best Picard episodes, or the most important Picard episodes, or, you know,
we will be talking about the flute.
Talking about that flute. Talking about you know, where it started, talking about where it ended, talking about Star Trek 09, which, you know, the events of which apparently have a big impact on the show, talking about some stuff that some various creators who are working on the show had a hand in Star Trek, you know, and whatever else comes up. So we're going to be doing this. It's going to be probably a bi-weekly commentary show. We know that we're going to start with Encounter at Farpoint and All Good Things. And we're going to end with Nemesis and Star Trek 09.
For some reason.
Because it's important to see where he's at now or last we saw him. And we're just going to kind of like follow it through, fill in the gaps, hit all the big things and see how much time we have. When we're going to start this, not 100% positive because, you know, this is part of a larger thing, you know, but we got to get everything kind of in place first. And we don't know exactly where it'll be, but it'll be here on Trek FM. If you subscribe to the master feed, you don't have to worry about where it'll be because it'll just be here.
Yeah.
So
it's like the seven signals. We don't know when they're going to happen, but we know there's a reason for them.
Yeah. So
maybe it's not a good one.
But it's a reason nonetheless. So, yeah, that should be fun. Something to look forward to. And, you know, we'll take breaks where we need to for short treks and other things and just kind of go with the flow. So, something to look forward to for sure. Well, be sure to check out our Discovery coverage throughout the week. Well, Live from the Edge, I guess that's kind of done with at this point, right? But Bruce and Brandy, you can find that show. And, Postcards from the Edge. I guess that's pretty much done too. I'm assuming, you know, Amy probably got her episode out already.
But it still exists. It's still available.
Oh, yeah, for sure. As is the full analysis on the Edge main show, which I don't think is going anywhere. That'll keep on going. And Notes from the Edge with Chris will surely be coming soon. So that's something to look forward to for sure. And yeah, no more tracks from the Edge for us, at least not for any time soon. But hey, Picard show. So
Picard show.
So yeah, lots of stuff. Just because Discovery's over doesn't mean the Edge is over. But you'll find all of these shows in the main feed for the Edge or in the Trek.fm master feed. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Discovery, and the best place to do that is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook, where Amy Nelson will collect your feedback for Postcards from the Edge. You can also find us on Twitter at Trek.fm. Or send us an email using the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose The Edge. You should probably also mention that when we're not here on Trek FM, we're over on our website, filmdamagepod.com, doing a show called Film Damage, where we take a look at movies from the perspective of the booth. We know that we owe people a explanation of that first scene of season two and the technical inaccuracies of the film projection for that video feed that we saw. So yeah,
specifically, ways in which film is not damaged.
There you go. Yes. So check that out. It'll be there. And you know, until it's there, we got a bunch of other episodes there which cover a wide range of things. If you want to know how film projection works from a very approachable level. You know, you don't need knowledge of technical stuff to understand what we're talking about. We try to break it down for you in experiential terms. So check that out. FilmDamagePod.com. Anyway, we'd like to thank our associate producers, Norman C. Lau, Tony Robinson, Thomas Puleo, Lisa Slack, Shoaib Mirza, Richard Rutledge, James Muldrow, Cornelia Reutner, Ryan Mallett, and Brian Maloche. Thank you very much, everybody. We really appreciate your support. Also, just want to say thank you to Tony Robinson for doing all of the episode artwork throughout the season. Very much appreciated. If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows going and even become an associate producer, visit patreon.com/trekfm for all the details. All right, another season of Star Trek in the books.
Yeah.
And then another one starts up in like, I don't know, 7 months?
Yeah.
8 months?
A ways off.
Not that far off.
Is Discovery coming back after Picard show?
Yes.
Thank God, that's going to be amazing.
Yeah, right? So, all right. It's been fun talking to you, and it's time to, I mean, because it's the end of the season, I think it's time to take the edge off, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.